Thank you, Tony. It is indeed a pleasure to be here. Actually, I've been angling for an invitation for almost 20 years. Tony was very nervous as to whether I'd make sense to the physicists, and I had promised him that I will do my best. That was a promise. So, can everybody hear me at the back? Yes, okay. So, in view of Everett's many world hypotheses, I have a talk which will actually, in the reality of this talk, will depend both on the observer and the presenter, okay? The path it will take will depend on how it's going and how you respond to what I have to present. So there's many different paths I can take on this talk. So the only thing I would encourage you to do is feel free to ask questions, and if I can answer them, we'll do that. So first thing I want to do is to put this thing in perspective, okay? The physicist here, so I want to let you know what I am doing here. So at the risk of overtly simplifying the continuum, I mean, yeah, I would think this is how I look at it. There is cosmology on one side, and there is the mainstream physics. And then there is in engineering. And cosmological questions are, you know, what determines the ratio of the gravitational force, the electrostatic force, and these numbers. Mainstream physics these days is one of the things in science news yesterday or last week was, why has mu changed by a tiny little bit? And so, those are interesting questions. And then there is engineering, which basically, you know, is a very useful field, but it's basically going to take the parameter that is given and then work out its implications, whether to design space vehicles or anything else. It takes little g as given and moves on. Okay? It's not that it's not important, but I think none of you are doing any research in this particular area. Most of the work is done here. This is very speculative stuff. It takes the brave to get there. And I guess string theory somewhere sitting there. Okay. So where does our field stand? Well, there is finance. There's mainstream finance, which is going to talk about what factors, such as book to market, size, affect equity returns. Okay, that's the, you know, it's the standard Chicago GSB finance. And then there is financial engineering. And that, I think, is very alike, akin to engineering, the relationship between physics and engineering. And you will find that these departments normally never exist in a finance department. They tend to be in stat departments and engineering economics departments. And essentially, just like this takes G as given, for financial engineering, what happens is that you combine two risky assets and you try to create a riskless asset. And once you have a riskless asset, you know the rate of return on all riskless assets in the absence of arbitrage must be the same. Now, the first people who found this, Black-Scholes and Merton, of course, it was a deep insight, and two of them went to Stockholm for that insight. But after that, you know, that was done. I mean, it's not an area of any research. So at least not in any of the mainstream finance departments. So they basically, the guys who will get involved in this sort of stuff are people who solve partial differential equations, and they normally sit in the stat, math, and they call themselves financial engineers. Some of them would never recognize a stock versus a bond, but that's a separate issue. This is macrofinance. This is where the plate tectonics meet. I mean, this is at the front lines of macroeconomics and finance. And there is, we ask the questions, you know, what determines the equity premium? I haven't defined it, will be defined in the next slide. But these guys take that as given, okay? And that's why the questions that we asked were never asked in finance earlier, because you need a well-developed theory of macroeconomics even to address these questions. So I just want to put the thing in perspective. So my talk is in this area. Okay, it's going to be very little, I might disappoint you, to do with making money, okay? But questions are, of course. Just like in physics, you have a set of postulates. In economics, I would argue that economic phenomena is an interaction amongst agents. It's the same agents who are acting in the markets of goods and services, were the market agents acting in insurance markets, in equity markets, etc. And what we find is that the equity premium puzzle, it's a glaring example where you have neoclassical, the standard dominant economic paradigm, one confronted with financial data. And it's a very powerful paradigm. This paradigm has impeccable origins. Robert Solow got a Nobel Prize for growth theory, which is what I would say one of the foundations of this paradigm. And then, of course, we have Finn Kidlin and Ed Prescott. Finn is right here in the audience. You know, they got it for real business cycle. So it is a powerful theory. But the thing is, when you take this very same model and you confront it with the financial data, it just doesn't do the job. And that, in essence, is the equity premium puzzle. So I am going to start absolutely at the scratch and define what is equity premium and then move on. Okay? So equity premium is nothing but the excess return earned by a security, such as a stock, with respect to a treasury bill. So it's just a risk premium. Okay? It's a risk premium of equities with respect to risk-free assets. By the way, Tony, how long do I have?
An hour.
Okay. Okay. We'll all right. And as such, it's one of the. It is the. I would say it is the key input for asset allocations. If you think stocks are going to do better than bonds, then obviously, stocks are going to, better than T-bills. You're going to be in stocks. But if you thought that the stocks were not going to do that well, you would, of course, reallocate your portfolio. So it's a key element in portfolio allocation and all corporate investment decisions. Okay. Let's look at some typical press remarks on the thing. This is a book by two guys at Cambridge University. Says equity premium is least understood pieces of economic research. Okay. No. And even specialists find it as terse and at times impenetrable. Now, you guys have taken the trouble to come here this afternoon, so I promise by the end of this lecture you will understand thoroughly what the equity premium puzzle is all about. Okay, it's actually pretty straightforward. Okay, so let's start with some data. So if you look at long periods of time. So we're looking at very low-frequency phenomena. We're not looking at day-to-day fluctuations in stock prices. We're looking at averages over hundreds of years. If you look at the real return, which is, it means inflation-adjusted return, that is, in constant dollars, you will see that you could look over, all, you know, you can take it post-war period. The equity premium has been about 7.1%. If you take it from, this was our original paper, which Prescott and I wrote in 79. So the data stops in 78, and that was 6.2%. That's just the same data updated now. It's actually gone up. Somebody told me today that it's going down. No, actually, the equity premium, this is the data set, which is the most accurate data set. This is the CRISP data set, which starts in 1926. That's the most reliable data set, it's 7.5. Point here is that it's a large number. It's a large number, and we're going to look at some cross-country data next. If you look at, if it was only a U.S. phenomena, then of course one could think it was, just an outcome of a stochastic process. The U.S. happened to get lucky, but if you look at almost all countries of the world, you have huge equity premium. Huge equity. Now you can look at different sub-periods. I broke it up before the gold standard and after the gold standard. The 33 was the gold standard. And you can see, actually, post 33, the equity premium shot up quite a bit. And it didn't shoot up in any odd manner. It shot up because the risk-free rate actually went down. The return on equity did not change. The risk-free rate actually fell quite a bit post the gold standard. Okay?
Yes. In
That is not right. In the 60s was a period of low inflation. There was a period of deflation, post-recession. So I don't know how you want to measure no inflation. In the 19th century. No, I wouldn't know. Finn, any idea about the 19th century inflation in the U.S.?
Low.
Low, okay.
Yeah, so that's why it is.
No, but these are all real returns. Everything is real. Everything is adjusted for inflation. So that wouldn't account for it. It's all adjusted for inflation. And if you're a weather forecaster, you're used to looking at moving averages. If you're looking at climate changes and things like that, you look at moving averages. So I kind of stuck in 30-year moving averages here. And you can see that the equity premium has been going up over time. So this is the point I was trying to make, is that the premium has been increasing over time, but this is largely due to the diminishing return on the riskless asset rather than an increase in the return on equity.
Can you go back?
Yes?
It seems like on this table and other tables, the decrease in the riskless return has gone down, but the equity premium has gone up even more.
Yeah, but largely due to, I mean, the dominant, if I was to pinpoint a dominant factor, I would say that it was, that went down from 3.3 to almost nothing. And if I add 3.3 to, that would become 7 and change. So the return on equity has gone up a little bit, but the dominant reduction, increase in the risk premium has come from that. And it, basically that's a huge. Is that a 125%? That probably is an error. Much should be more than. Yeah. Okay. And this is something for our students to look at. I mean, there is this, whether the gold standard had to do something with it. This is something that I, recently kind of stumbled on, that the gold standard may have something to do with it. I haven't fully explored this phenomenon. Okay. But let's look at, I mean, those numbers are okay, but if you want to look at the real implications of this thing, is that, look, if you had invested just a dollar in stocks in 1926, so a benevolent grandparent had put some money for you, you would have got $407,000 per dollar. Sorry, $407, whereas in T-bills it was 1.67. The ratio is 244. Okay, the ratio is hugely high, and let me just show it to you in another way. There we are. I think. Can you guys at the back read it? If you can't read it, I'll just. So if you had, if you had a dollar given to you in 25 and you had put it in T-bills, well, it would have been worth, T-bills is right here, $17.87. Inflation would have eaten up 10.82. And you could have taken a friend out to coffee at Starbucks. That would have been nice. But if your grandfather had given you $1,000 there, hey, that would be worth over $12 million, and you would be competing with Jeff Henley for a house in Santa Barbara. So that's the difference, okay? So let me give you a little background how we stumbled upon this. Like in all things, we didn't consciously sit down to figure out that there was an equity premium puzzle or anything like that. I'm just giving you so I'm just showing you, I'm coming to the puzzle. So we were looking at this graph one time, way back in 79, Ed and I on a summer afternoon, I was sitting there and looking at it. And what had happened, a couple of things that happened in Bob Lucas had an asset pricing model, which, Ed and I extended and kind of decentralized that model and got prices in a production-based economy. And we basically said, let's check it out and see whether you know, when we appropriately calibrate this model, we can, it's all replicate. In other words, I mean, basically, the story that far was that, you know, inflation adjusted, the stock market had, in the last 115 years, had been 7.6%, and this exceed, you know, that exists even when you take out the great bull market from 1982 to 2000. And over the same period, real return on government bills was 1%, and that difference is the equity thing. So why is it a puzzle? It's a puzzle because it defies easy explanation in the standard theories of asset prices. So let me just... So is this a premium? One thing you would think about is, why do have stocks given you such a high rate of return? If I just ask you this question in the class, in the audience here, you are going to tell me that, look, stocks are riskier. And this is a premium for bearing risk. Okay? And that's what we did. We took that seriously and saw whether it is actually a premium for bearing risk. And I'll show you what we get out. Okay? And why have stocks been such an attractive investment to relative bonds? I mean, you really need to look at this picture one more time. This is a log scale, by the way. If it was a linear scale, we would be on the top floor of this building, because this is a that is a huge gap. Okay, that is a huge gap. And you know, why have they been such an attraction? Now, one intuitive answer is that since stocks are riskier than bonds, investors require a larger premium for bearing additional risk. I mean, that was the standard view. Nobody ever questioned. I mean, there was never a question. The word equity premium puzzle would never existed, you know, prior to 1980 or 79 when we got this thing. Because it was taken as a God-given fact. So here is where I wanted the first slide, is that people took these numbers as, these are the numbers. And then you have to start asking yourself, you know, whether these numbers make sense relative to all the other numbers that I am observing. I mean, got all these forces, and then I have one force which is so weak. What the hell is happening? Is it going through some other dimensions? And here, start thinking about what is going through this. All right. Now, stocks have a standard deviation about 20%, and T-bills have a standard deviation of 4%. And this was the conventional wisdom that, you know, obviously they are more risky than bills. But are they? We got to actually check this thing out. Are they in a well-defined economic model of? Can you guys hear me at the back? Okay.
Okay.
So that's the question. But are they?
That's what the question we ask. And you can look at how these things look up to 2004. Stocks go all over the place. They go up and they go down. And this is also going to be a good example that eyeballing is not a good way to do science. Look at that. That's the series of stocks going through time. And that's T-bills. And you can see around the Great Depression, there was a big movement. So this is the real return on data. Here isn't so good. I actually, there was no T-bills there, so I went to basements of various libraries and got prime commercial paper and things like that. But you know, generally that's been overlooked. They've been looked over many, many times. So if you look at these series, you know, basically we can go home and say, well, stocks are riskier than bonds. Therefore, what's the problem? And let's life should be as usual, okay? And that's how they existed. I mean, finance took this as a parameter and went merrily along its way. Macroeconomics didn't think it was a problem and went along its way. It's like relativity and quantum mechanics, both very successful theories, going there merrily their way. And then when you confront them at very, very small scales, you start seeing a problem, okay? So let us ask a question. Well, this is how we started asking the question. Is why do different assets yield different rates of return? Okay? And here I would encourage you to ask me any questions, because this is the part of the paper where I'm going to give you some ideas as to how economists think about these issues. So why do they give you different rates of return? If you're going to ask, it is a premium for bearing risk, then one should know why different assets give you different.
Now, that's the only bit of jargon I'm going to give you. Assets are priced ex ante such that the loss in marginal utility, that is, the loss in well-being or your welfare, are incurred by sacrificing consumption and buying an asset. After all, if you buy an asset, you have to forego some consumption today. You can't spend it on, you know, some other good. So you're going to lose some utility or some well-being by buying this asset. And why do you buy it? Because you think this asset is going to pay off in the future and increase your well-being in the future. So on the margin, this should be the same. Okay? That's the key thing. So let's go. But the other thing you have to realize is that the same amount of consumption may result in different degrees of well-being at different points in time. So if I give you a 5-course dinner, after a heavy lunch will give you considerably less satisfaction than a similar dinner when you're hungry. Okay? So it's not a question of me taking $10 and giving back $10. It also depends on when you get those $10. So, from an investor's perspective, desirability of a security depends on, when this security is going to pay off. Okay, so let's look at it intuitively. If a security is going to pay off really well when consumption is low, when times are bad, and a security pays you, you are going to like that security because it's providing consumption when times are scarce. Okay. On the other hand, I just told you, because your incremental increase in well-being is going to be inversely proportionate to how much consumption you have. The smaller your consumption, the more desirable additional consumption will be. And if you have a lot of consumption, and if I pay off more consumption, relatively it will be less desirable. Since everybody here, there's nobody mathematically challenged here or algebraically challenged, let's look at it and show you asset pricing in one slide. Let's look at two states of the world. There is a high consumption state, which I'm going to call a boom state of the world, and a low consumption state, which is a recession. And I have two securities. I am going to be both of them. Both these states are equally likely. That's not important for the example, but I just made them equally likely. This security A is going to give you $20,000 in the boom state and nothing in the state of recession. And B is going to give you $0 in the boom state and nothing in the state with recession. All right? The expected payoff for both these securities is the same. Okay? And let the price of security A be P and that of B be Q. So let me ask our physics students here, which security would you rather have? Which one do you prefer more, A or B? For the same expected payoff, you are going to prefer B. What does that mean in plain English? If you prefer something more, you're going to pay more for it. So the price of B is going to be higher than the price of A. If the price of B, which is Q, if Q is a larger number than P, what about the rate of return on security B? It's going to be lower than the rate of return on security A. That's it. It's as simple as that. Why do different securities give you different rates of returns? They give you different rates of returns because they pay off in different states of the world. Okay? That's the name of the game. They pay off in different states of marginal utility. They provide, because when times are scarce, then the incremental value of this payment is a lot more. And therefore, you're going to pay more for it. So when you adjust for size, this is why when you look at different stocks and bonds, the zillions of securities, the theory is just very simple. Okay? We can put in a lot of math, but at ground zero, this is it. There's nothing more deep about it. Okay, I'm going to skip that. Let's illustrate this with the CAPM. I mean, everybody knows, What is a CAPM? I mean, CAPM is something that you may have casually picked up while reading a finance book or something. It basically postulates a linear relationship. By the way, this was developed by three gentlemen, Littner, Jan Mohsen, and Bill Sharpe. Unfortunately, Littner and Mohsen died before the prize was given, so Bill Sharpe got a prize for getting this thing done. But again, part of the work was done at Carnegie by Jan Mohsen. What does this say? It says, well, look, the expected return on any asset is the risk-free rate. So you get a time value of money. You get a risk-free rate, plus you get a premium for bearing risk. Okay? That's nothing but the equity premium. That's just the equity premium. And beta is a relative measure of risk. Okay? So I've written it as the covariance over a variance, but you can simplify it. And what you're going to get, the reason I've written it this way, is that that is just a measure of risk of security J. That's called the systematic risk of security J relative to the systematic risk of the market. Of course, correlation of the market with itself is 1. Rho mm is 1. But I just wanted to, you know, make it a symmetric notation. So this basically tells you the rate of return on an asset is equal to the risk-free rate plus some fraction of the equity premium. If you take the same risk as the market, you're going to get 1 equity premium. If you take twice the risk of the market, you're going to get 2 times the equity premium. So the expected return is going to be dependent on the risk-free rate and the risk you take relative to the market. Now, when you look at the CAPM, which is basically the favorite model of a lot of finance guys, of course, the model has nothing to say what the equity premium should be. It's an external. But why, you know, people would say this is a high beta stock. How many heard about the word beta in your casual investing? You know the beta of a stock is high or a beta of a stock is low. But why do high beta securities give you a high rate of return? I tell you, if you ask this question to a grad student in economics, the guy will tell you, well, a high beta security covaries highly with the market. But that's by definition a high beta security. There's nothing new there. What happens is in the CAPM that good times and bad, the indicator of good times and bad times is the market. The indicator of good times and bad times is the market. So a security which is highly correlated with the market tends to pay off relatively more in good times. Then, as we've argued earlier, if securities tend to pay off relatively more in good times, then they are paying in less desirable states because you already have a lot of money and you are going to get additional money. So those will be valued less highly than securities that pay off in bad times. And therefore, you will get a higher rate of return. So that's the intuitive reason. Of course, there's nothing God-given that there should be only one indicator of good times and bad times. There are many ad hoc models in finance, by the way. The current favorite is the Farmer's French three-factor model, which has 3 different indicators of good times and bad times. Again, quite ad hoc. That's why in my first diagram, it comes in the middle. I mean, they just look at data and they try to figure out factors which explain these returns. But that's the reason why. No, nothing implicit. It's basically what we're looking at is essentially a buy and hold strategy. Okay, we're looking here on over long periods of time. We're not market timing or anything here. We're looking at very low frequency stuff. Okay, I'll come to some of that stuff in about 10 minutes as to what we're. No. Although that's not a bad way to do it. That's called dollar cost averaging. Okay, a lot of people use it, and there is some merit to doing that. That's not built into this, not at all. Yeah. Well, we're looking at that. You know, the markets are not going to be in disequilibrium for a long period of time. Yeah. It could be completely. We have nothing to say about that. So, and I'm just going to skip over this. I just told you what I just. Another way that I like to look at asset pricing is risk. A risky asset is one which destabilizes consumption. Anybody who's a risk-averse individual likes a smooth consumption over your lifetime. We like smooth consumption rather than, you know, feast and famine. We like smooth consumption. So assets which destabilize consumption, that is, pump in more consumption when times are already good and suck out consumption when times are bad, are risky assets from an economic standpoint. That is risk. Okay? Risk is an asset which destabilizes consumption. And insurance policies, if you know, are a classic example of this. You actually hold an insurance policy, which is no different than holding the stock. It just pays off randomly. But and you actually hold it even if you get a negative rate of return. After all, the insurance companies are making money on that, right? But why do you hold it willingly? Because it's smooth consumption. When your house burns down, or when there is a flood, when the wolf's at the door, you are going to get a nice check. It's smooth consumption. So actually, an insurance policy is a negative risk policy asset. It actually smooths consumption, and therefore, it actually sucks out risk from your consumption stream. Whereas a risk-free asset would leave the variability of the consumption stream unchanged. Right? If I combine a random variable with a constant, the standard deviation might decline, but the coefficient of variation will not change on that one. But so insurance policies are negative risk assets, and you're willing to hold them for not the risk-free rate, but actually a negative rate of return. So that is what asset pricing is all about, to see when these assets are paying off. So now I've given you a framework for analysis. So we look at, now you can see what the next step is. I'm going to see when stocks paid off, and I'm going to see when bonds paid off. In our minds, we always think bonds are, or T-bills are, riskless. What is a riskless asset? If there are two states of the world, if an asset is riskless, if you're following what I said, how should it pay off across the two states? The same, right? If T-bills paid off the same and stocks paid off only in good times and not so much in bad times and nothing in bad times, then by what I have said, it stocks would be riskier than T-bills. So let's look at what the surprise is. So are stocks that much riskier than bills to justify a 7% differential in yield? So now we have a quantitative model, and we can judge that. And this came as a real shocker. This actually came as a real shocker to both of us, Ed and I, that any which way we would cut it, okay, we really couldn't get this 7% premium. In fact, we couldn't even get 1% of a premium using standard theory. So this was a crisis. I mean, we got a standard model which is so successful. Around that time, Ed was working with Finn also, developing real business cycle theory. So this is all being done in late 70s, early 80s. And it does such a great job in explaining so many different facets of the economy that when you confronted the same model here, this was the shocker. Stocks and bonds pay off in approximately the same states of nature. You see, your intuitive mindset is that stocks, their payoffs are very variable, and T-bills, as a lot of the smart grad students there said, if they were truly risk-free, they would pay off independent of the state of the world. But when you start looking at these things, what the key thing is that they pay off in approximately the same states of nature. And as we argued earlier, then they should command approximately the same rate of return. There is no reason, if you look at reams and reams of, so once we put this out, and we could get at most of 1%. I mean, amount we got pissed on this paper, it's not even funny. We wrote this paper in 79, and basically it took us six more years. Okay, look, that's the thing. The point is, I'm not looking at 5 years, 2 years, 10 years. I'm looking at 115 years worth of data. I mean, you have to think that people were systematically, in some manner, never updated their beliefs. I mean, everything is a puzzle with respect to some model. You have the dominant paradigm in every profession. I mean, when you say something is inconsistent, it is inconsistent relative to some existing paradigm. And I find it very hard to think. I think, yeah, there is a, I think, well, one way I would say it, okay, I'll answer it in a positive manner. I would like to take credit for the bull market from 72 to 2000, when people found out that equity was such a good deal when the time this was published, right? We had a tremendous bull market from 82 to 2000, and I wish I got even a tiny commission for on all the money that was made. But it was really, I mean, the reason nobody wanted to believe it was such a, you know, in your face to standard theory. That look, it just doesn't work. I mean, and it was not a small failure. I mean, it was over an order of magnitude failure. It was just a failure. And whether people believe it or not, I mean, the amount of dissertations and papers that have been written to explain the puzzle, and I'm going to show you how you can explain it also. I mean, we made some progress in the last 20 years. We had a conference here, as you know, in October to discuss research in this area. But boy, did four of the top journals turned this paper down. We had a very hard time getting this published. One of Ed's advisors and my professor, Robert Lucas, actually had to intervene to get the paper into print. And then once it was in print, of course, it became a cottage industry. People thought, you know, we're going to just whip up something and solve it. There was a huge amount of tries. I'm going to show you some aspect of that. But so basically, what was done? I wanted to show you that, you know, we economists also do some serious work. So you had the stochastic growth model. Okay, you got a growth model there, and what we did was we decentralized the model. Once you decentralize the model, what you do is you have individuals maximizing utility and firms maximizing profits. You get prices out of it. In this model here, of course, there is no prices. Once you have prices, you have rates of return, and I'm going to skip over this thing, but there is serious stuff going on behind that, okay? How to decentralize the stochastic growth model.
I'd still like to ask this
okay.
question. I remember
Well, India's time period was much smaller. It's 91 to this thing. Everything else was from 1900.
And India was like about twice as much as England. So clearly it reflects some kind of belief in the West in India versus India. So is there some other explanation for it? It's almost back to school.
Well, the consumption, obviously this is going to, so at the end of the day, what is our indicator of good times and bad times? It's consumption, right? So you have to see how asset returns vary with consumption. And obviously, if you look at it across, so there is, that's an empirically observed phenomenon, right? What I showed you was what there exists.
So how do you explain the expected?
Well, we're not. That's minor. That I would say is almost nothing. We're trying to explain factors of 10 at the moment. Okay. Theory cannot explain an equity premium of even 1%.
Why is that risk?
I don't know what you mean by risk. I just defined what risk was. I mean, I defined very precisely from the perspective of an investor, risk is, a risky asset is one which destabilizes your consumption path on a per dollar basis. Of course, I'm going to normalize the whole thing. That's why I look at rates of return. Normalize a risky asset versus a non-risky asset is one which destabilizes consumption. So think insurance policy versus a stock. an insurance policy actually stabilizes consumption.
So you don't think it's an
I don't. Well, there is a lot of behavioral finance people who've given it a shot. You know, we can, in fact, well, they bring up a model. You see, one of the things which you as a physicist will appreciate is what I call cross-model verification. This is a term which I have used earlier, and that is the following. If I want to get an explanation for a certain behavior, then that explanation must not be inconsistent with every other thing I know. You see, if I was to explain, here is a simple thing. I mean, I often use this in front of you know, lay audiences. You take a piece of paper and you drop a coin here, okay? And the coin is going to fall faster. And if you do audience of physicists, you say, well, the gravity attracts the coin more strongly. That could be one explanation, but it would be inconsistent with everything else you know. You've abstracted away from a central key phenomena which affects the fall of the paper. So that's the thing. So what do the behavioral finance guys do? Essentially, they will come up with a story. You can always come up with a story. Then what happens is, let me give you one example of a story, which is by one of my own co-authors. And he's not a behavioral finance guy, but this is a story dealing with habit formation. That is that, look, you know, your utility does not depend on some absolute level, but it depends on what you're used to in the past. Okay, so you can develop a model where essentially the utility will be a function of C minus some constant. Okay, so the marginal utilities were going to be much higher around C. But then if you take the same utility function and then you put it in real business cycle theory, it kills everything else we know there. You see, now, so how much, what would you call that as progress? Because now I can explain one more phenomena that, and I'm at inconsistent with everything else. And that's the hard part in this modeling. You can always come up with some story that is going to explain this. The hard part is to, the late Fisher Black of option pricing fame, how did he explain the equity premium puzzle? He said, just assume people are very risk averse. You see, obviously, it's a quantitative puzzle. It's not a qualitative puzzle. We do get an equity premium of 1%, right? So we do say stocks are riskier than bonds. So we are all agreed on that. How much more? Well, how much more will depend on how risk-averse agents are. So you have to infer people's risk aversion from other experiments. But supposing I was to use risk aversion factor of 55, I can solve it. I can solve this puzzle, and this guy, you know, he's one of the brightest people that I've known, would typically, if those of you who interacted with him, typically calls you on Sunday morning and say, this is Fisher. And then after a while, my wife would say, this is another one of your crazy friends who's calling and just saying, you know, but he would try to call me every day, every Sunday. He would call up and try to convince me that, you know, no problem having. But let me tell you what the problem is. For instance, if you are that risk averse, then interest rates are also going to be determined in this model. Then, because the growth rate of consumption, say, in a country like Korea is so much higher than the United States, then the level of interest rates there should be much higher than here. So we have a lot of indirect evidence. This is why I said, this is research in the area where you're looking at grand unified theories and things like that. We want to get a theory here which can explain a huge bunch of different phenomena. If I just want to explain the equity premium puzzle, hey, you know, I could give you lots of stories which will do that, including alpha equal to 55. But if I look at other forms of human behavior, if I say, would you like to have a bath, for instance, in the morning? If you had a risk aversion of 55, none of you will have a bath, because there is a small probability that you will slip in the tub and crack your nut. You know, then we can see, you know, how you're acting. Will you cross the street? Will you get up from the chair? Well, how confused would you be? I mean, look, we let risk aversion go up to 10. I mean, no study has found it more than 3 or 4, right? We say, well, let's assume that it would be 10, which is way out of bounds.
You wrote down the model. You said the model assumes a linear group.
That was one particular model. That is, that has nothing to do with our stuff. Has nothing. That just
to the numbers.
That has to do with the curvature parameters in our models, but nothing to do with that linear model. That's a silly model, which a lot of people use. I was just showing it why it happens, because in that model, good times and bad times is indicated by one variable, which is the market. There's no reason that should be the case. In our models, good times and bad times are indicated by consumption levels from wherever they come from. We don't look at whether it comes from the market or anything else. Could be wages, could be other areas. Yes, ma'am? Well, there's something to what you said. I mean, who is the marginal person in these markets? I mean, that's something that we can argue about. And where will that come in? What is the risk aversion of the marginal person, right? At some level, the companies which allocate your assets, if they were a lot more risk averse, then we could plug in their number. But, generally, accepted numbers for risk aversion are somewhere around 3, 4, 5. I mean, after that, you're treading on. You're going to see a lot of inconsistencies in everything. So it's a deep question. You know, who is the marginal person in this market? Is it going to be a fund manager? Or is it going to be one of us? Or who is the marginal person? And what is their risk aversion? I mean, that's what matters. Is the risk aversion of the marginal person? But here is what I will tell you something. If you have a lot of securities traded, which economists call almost complete markets, okay? If I have a lot of securities being traded, then what I can do is I can abstract the allocations in this economy as if they were generated by a representative agent. And that can happen under, if you have lots of securities being traded, we have some aggregation results. And when we look at those models and confront them with various types of data, numbers which fit the data, what I would do is I would use something orthogonal to the phenomena being studied and pick up the parameters. And the parameters that work are small numbers, not 55, not even close to 10. Yes, sir?
Is this cross-cultural or cross-country, this result? From what I read in the papers, there are places where the consumption level, the absolute rate of consumption, say in China, is much lower than here, and yet they save a lot more of their.
No, their consumption. Their savings rates are much higher. So we are saving. We are eating what the Chinese are saving to some extent.
They're saving. So the marginal. You would say the marginal utility of consumption is lower there because they're obviously saving more.
No, the marginal utility of consumption will be higher there because they're consuming less. Less.
I don't know how you define it. I would say that their desire to spend the money is less than their desire to save.
Well, that will depend what is going to happen in the future, right? So let's take a very simple example of interest rate determination. Say I am in an economy. I'm going to take one second to answer your question. So this is a rice field here, okay? And every period there is some rainfall there, okay? And we're going to exchange rice for this period to next period. If I take a bushel of rice from you now, when say the aggregate output was 100 bushels, I took one bushel from you, and I gave you rice next period when there were lots and lots of rice, right? And I gave you a bushel of rice, you would not think it's a fair trade because I took rice from you in states when it was in relative scarcity and gave it back to you when there was plenty of rice. So I have to give you a little bit more, right? That's why rates are positive. That's one of the rates are positive. Now let's look at an economy, where you're going to get, next period is really going to be bad, right? So I say, well, friend, I want a bushel of rice now and I'll give you one next period. What are you going to tell me? Take a walk, because next period there isn't going to be much rice, right? So I might be able to, you might say, well, look, give me 5 units of rice today and I will give you 1 unit next time, in which case the interest rates are going to be negative. I mean, something like this happened in Japan also. So if you never want to live in an economy where rates, real rates of return are zero, because that's an economy without any growth. That would not be a fun place to. Let me move on. I got about 5 minutes to go, and I want to show you some good stuff here. So this is basically the results. The resistance came from the fact that, you know, prima facie, the viability of these classes of models was thrown into question. And then especially the quantitative numbers. People estimated cost of business cycle fluctuation. They said, well, business cycles cost almost nothing. Then my answer question would be, well, look, this is the same model which is saying the equity premium is 1%. Why should I believe your calculations about business cycle fluctuation? So it did create quite a bit of stir when you give quantitative. Well, that is why over the 20 years this has become a huge pastime, okay? Let me just tell you what, you put different assumptions, modified probability distribution, survival bias, incomplete markets, market imperfections, limited participation, intertemporal, you know, you can do lots of things. And my favorite study, of course, one of the papers we have done with our co-authors, which go completely outside this model and start looking at an overlapping generations scenario where you have life cycle effects. And using those life cycle effects, we can come up with, at least, we're not an order of magnitude off. I'm not going to go into the details of that, so I am going to skip a couple of things, but I want to come to this question, is the equity premium likely to persist? And there's a lot of people, Tony was mentioning this, well, look, you know, the price earnings ratios are very high, et cetera, and you come down, essentially, if you work in this area, you come down to a cocktail party or any such thing, people just going to ask you, well, what is going to be the equity premium? And a lot of people think that there is no equity premium. So you want to differentiate between the ex ante equity premium or the ex post equity premium. Okay? And that's what we addressed. We looked at the ex post realized equity premium over. But if you look at the ex ante equity premium, that's the forward looking premium. That has to be positive. Remember, all stocks have to be held. If we all thought, if the marginal guy in the market thought that the equity premium was negative, what would you do? You would only hold bonds and you would not hold stocks. And the stock prices will go down and then the bond prices are going, the stock prices will go up. So the stock prices will go down and the rate of return will come up. Okay, so remember, you can't. Many times, and I've come to professional conferences like a TIA CREF where we allocate your pension money. There are people, serious academics, sitting there and saying, well, I think the equity premium over the next year is going to be this number. But as I shall tell you, it is no different, it is isomorphic to predicting the equity return. The same gentleman would say, if I ask him what is the rate of return in the market, say, well, you know, do you think I'm a fool or a you know, looking at stars or stargazing or an astrologer that I can tell you what the rate of return is. But if you ask them what the equity premium is, they will take a stand on it. So after a bull market, when stock valuations are relatively high, the ex ante equity premium is likely to be low. That's because of mean reversion. But this is precisely the times when the realized one is going to be high. So when you talk about what equity premium you're talking about, you have to be very careful. Are you looking at the realized equity premium, or are you looking at the ex ante equity premium? What I want to show you that what we did is for very long planning horizons. Okay, so it's a question of conditional expectation rather than unconditional expectation. Okay, so what we document has very little to do with what the premium is going to be over the next 1 year. You know, the ex post equity premium is just a realization of the stochastic process, right? And it has varied considerably. Let me show you. This is the plot of the realized equity premium. It's all over the place. If you look at 1 year horizon, but look what happens at 20 year horizon. No. That's 1 year. That's over 20 years. You can see this is the basis of a lot of investment advice that you get. The U.S. stock market, for as long as we have data, you know, over a 20-year period, you never got a negative equity premium. Now think about the following. If you look at just the standard deviation as a measure of risk, you've got two random variables, a bounded support. One has a much higher standard deviation than the other. But if the support of one of the random variables is higher than the support of the other random variable, there is stochastic dominance there, right? So I really don't care how variable it is, but over 20-year period. And the reason for this is stocks are mean reverting because things got to add up. The rate of return over all forms of capital, you got to take, they got to add up to no more than 4%. Because that's the rate of return on capital in the economy. So you can't have sectors growing at 30% a year for that long. I mean, this is just not going to be possible. Tony, let me just show one more slide because and then we'll take questions. And look at the variation. I mean, if you want to look at what risk is, oh, there we are. It's going to go back. Okay, if somebody asks me what is financial risk, I'll say this is financial risk. This is what you're staring at risk. Because you see, what I have done is I've taken the entire stock market valuation, privately held equity as well as publicly traded equity, and divided by national income, which is GDP minus depreciation. And now you see what is happening. This thing fluctuates from about 2 GDP to about half a GDP. That's it. That's the fluctuation. And it's a very low frequency fluctuation. It's a very low frequency fluctuation. And most of us, it's no point working here and retiring here, okay? That's very risky. On average, I could say that the market is going to be fine, but it may be after you're dead, right? That is true. That is risk. I mean, this is not just yo-yoing of the market on a daily basis. This is high frequency stuff. That goes away. Yes, Tony.
Oh, high-tech
stocks. Yeah, I am doing this, as I said. I am doing it at a very aggregated level, right? It will be different in different sectors. I'm looking at the whole market. I'm looking at the premium of the entire stock. If I cannot explain the mean return on the entire stock relative to the mean return on a risk-free asset. Surely, I mean, on the tech side, it will be higher. The equity premium is going to be higher. I have data on that, and if you like, I will send you a file. There is also some data that value stocks, low PE ratio stocks, do better than high PE ratio stocks. Growth stocks in general do worse, do better. Size, there is a size effect which is there. But those, you see, that's mainstream finance. Again, you're looking at all these issues. We're not looking at that. That's why I wanted to get that first slide out. I'm just trying to get a model here which will... And if you look at mean equity premium 3 years ahead, and you can see that the valuation of the market relative to GDP does indeed, to some extent, forecast... future equity premium. I mean, it's not. Here's what I did. Let me show you one more stuff. There. I look at the average value of. This is about one. So I've looked at overvaluation and undervaluation. And so this is overvaluation when the market value is over one GDP, and undervaluation is period when it is below one GDP. And I just average the equity premium in those parts. And again, to the best of my knowledge, I haven't seen this done anywhere else. I'm still working out the implications of this.
After the 1929 crash, yeah.
Well, up to...
After 1929.
Well, yeah, relative to historical levels. It took a while for it to fall. I mean, this is... if I look at the average of this process, it's one. Okay, that's all I'm saying.
But now it's almost at an all-time high.
It's a high, but it has come down a little bit. See, this is through 2004. 2001. Yeah, this is 2004, this is one of the reasons a lot of people think that the forward-looking equity premium is going to be low. That's one of the reasons people keep talking about the forward-looking equity premium being low, because historically, by historical numbers,
This is also the same across countries?
No, I have data. I've done this thing for Australia. I've done this thing for India. Only because the Indians and the Australians invited me to give lectures on this stuff. So when I went there, I did this stuff for them. But so what is it? Estimating the conditional equity premium is no means a simple task. It's isomorphic to forecasting, equity returns. And since returns have a standard deviation of 20% per year, the noise is going to dominate the drift. Okay, so operationally. People who say that I know what the equity premium is going to be, my challenge to them is how much information is there, knowing that the mean is 2% rather than 6% when the standard deviation is 20%. I mean, you really cannot figure that out. So the bottom line is that, even if the conditional equity premium, given current market conditions, is small, and there is some consensus that it is small, it doesn't imply that it was obvious that either the historical premium was too high or that the unconditional premium had. Okay, we're going to skip that. Because you could do the whole thing before the great crash and see what happened. I mean, and you would have come up with it. What I would end with the following thing. The data used to document the equity premium over 100 years is about the best economic series that we have. And it's a long series. And before you want to dismiss the premium, not only do you need to understand the observed phenomena, but also you need a plausible explanation as to why the future is likely to be different from the past. And that's why you want to construct these type of theories, because you want to tie these to underlying events so that you can know what is happening, rather than just ad hocly fitting something. And there's a lot of work done in this area. I mean, that's all I could do in an hour. But I could send you some more stuff if you want.
Thank you.
David? Yes, sir. Okay, I never normally answer that question, but this is a friendly audience. I will do that. 100% equity.
100% what?
Equity, since I joined Columbia in 77. Actually, since before I joined Columbia, I spent a year at Queen's University in Kingston. The $2,000 that I put there in 76 is definitely into six figures. So I would say, if you have a long planning horizon, and the past. Look, I mean, you have to believe in stationarity, right? If you're going to learn something, but by the way, diversified portfolio of equity, which does not mean Standard & Poor's 500, mm-hmm. which does not mean the Wilshire. I mean, that would constitute a very small part of your portfolio. Latin America, by the way, as you know, if you've been diversified nicely, yesterday was a 2% day, which is a three sigma event, or four. Five sigma even. Well, I mean, if you're diversified well, which includes Russia, Latin America, Europe, emerging markets, there's a huge market out there, and you must diversify across the board, and it's very easy to do these days. You got ETFs, which are exchange-traded funds, okay? And you basically a very low-cost way to do it. You don't have to pay fancy fees for it. The name of the game is diversification. And buy and hold. I mean, yes.
So you talked at you gave numbers on. I mean, the stocks were in the stuff all by all.
No, that isn't.
But you said the stigma, I mean, the variation, the capacity, right? In the secular trend, which we're discussing at the moment, that the short time fluctuation
is 20% a year.
20% a year.
On
now
equity.
That's for equity.
4% for T-bills.
So, I mean, it seems to me. But isn't part of the puzzle that, namely, people are risk averse, and their perception of risk as an integrator of every example of the time, they see 20%. And 20% is a lot.
Yeah, but you see,
in
what?
A year, and they get moved all the time, up, down, by 2%, and it's scary. whereas T-bonds are much lower high frequency stochastic variations. Therefore, they seem a lot more secure, even though
they are not. That's the puzzle. That's
yes, but people think on the short term where they see that. So, if, you know, if you're driving on a their perception is not of the regular 20 years or even 3 years, but day to day.
No, but why? You're eating. What we're looking at consumption, right? What you're eating out of these. So when, why do you buy the people? The theory says you're going to buy.
If you're, you know, there's also gambler's ruin. If you're having big fluctuations, you can be. As you said yourself, you know, you wouldn't want to.
No,
it's fine if you have a long time user base, but if you happen to need the money at the time you earn those profits.
No, I think that's misreading the thing. What's happening is, why do you buy a security? You buy a security for smooth consumption. I mean, at the heart of this is the argument is that when I buy a security, I am sacrificing current consumption in the hope of getting consumption in the future, right? Now, if I look at when these two, so there are two mechanisms of smoothing consumption. You could buy stocks to smooth consumption, or you could buy tables to smooth consumption. Now you look at when these things pay off. I'm just reporting what you see. Now, if you are wondering, if you say my planning horizon is one day, the point is that I'm trying to look at, but these theories, by the way.
What time period would it take to achieve a difference of 20% to 4%?
Right, I can answer that question for you. If this was an IID process, time scaling wouldn't matter, right? But it is not an IID process. Stocks are mean reverting, and bonds are actually mean averting. So what happens is you start getting in-sample stochastic dominance of stocks versus bonds. Again, in samples, stochastic dominance at about 8 years, 9 years frequency. It's a marginal guy, but it's the point is somebody else can smooth it. You may not want it, but then I have to take advantage of that fact that if you are so myopic that you only want 1 year, if you were pricing it, right, and if I have a longer pricing horizon, then, you know, I got a free lunch there. And you would no longer would be the marginal guy. Yes, sir. Okay, the bond market is much larger, order of magnitude larger than this. But the point is, so here is a potential resolution of a puzzle, okay? Prescott and I would argue, if you asked us today, I'd say that the guy who is marginal in the stock market is not the guy who is marginal in the T-bill market. The T-bill market is not being used to smooth intertemporal consumption. It is being held by the Chinese government or the Indian government or petrodollars. So it's a different person or a different mechanism for smoothing. So, I mean, I haven't told you, I basically outlined what the main puzzle is, but yes. You have to argue that it's the same guy using these two securities to smooth consumption. If I was to say that the guy who is holding T-bills is not using them to smooth intertemporal consumption, and there is some evidence to that, then this loses some of the punch, right? You have to have, to make this an argument, you have to have the securities for intertemporal consumption smoothing. No. The bond market is much bigger than the stock market. I have advised the Indian government, yes, but not the Chinese.
So one of you graphs was average pricing on the stock market is greater than 59 months, but then
yeah, they do. Of course, there's a survival bias, right? So basically, yeah. So what we do is we rebalance every year. Uh-huh. We're rebalancing at annual frequency. So we take that into account. Yeah. We rebalance. By the way, people who tell you have a buy and hold strategy, if you read the Standard Finance textbook, I would strongly argue against the buy and hold strategy. I would argue in favor of an annual rebalancing, because what happens is, if you just had a buy and hold strategy, say in 1926, you would never have had Microsoft, you would never have had Intel, you wouldn't have had all these things. So what happens is, you don't want to rebalance on a daily basis, but you know, every 6 months or a year, for what reasons, you might want to rebalance, and that will actually, if you did this in a buy and hold strategy from 26 to now, versus annual rebalancing, annual rebalances gives you 2% compounded, which is a huge amount. So you want to annually rebalance, and that's what we do.
By the way, Adrian, going to face the debt, experimentally
better.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done a financial engineering in the last 30, 35 years or so. Have the ability to change the equity premium.
Financial engineering?
Has the fact it's become more widespread.
Why, it's neutral to this thing. Why? Because these are derivative markets, right? Essentially, what is the financial engineer doing? A financial engineer is going to create a product which is basic and price it by comparing it with something else. That's why I call it a derivative security. There are completely different things going on here. When I'm trying to price a stock or I'm pricing a bond, so let's look at Lego blocks here, okay? I got Lego blocks, I got red Lego blocks, and I got blue Lego blocks. Red Lego blocks cost 10 cents and blue ones cost 5 cents, okay? If I build a structure with so many red Lego blocks and so many blue blocks, then I know what the price of that structure is just by knowing the price of the red block and the blue block. The hard part is, what is the price of the red block and what is the price of the blue block? So financial engineering completely circumvents this thing. They will price a synthesize an asset depending on existing assets, and they just take read off the prices of these.
But if you're interested in some strategy and you go out and buy some kind of stock at the head, you're buying it for a different reason. If you have a large amount of quantity, it makes you think you'd be evaluating the riskiness of that asset in a totally different way, because you're buying it as a guarantee, or you're buying it as part of some more complicated.
I mean, you have to ask, you know, what is the
too short term?
It's being bought for some reason, right? To hedge or anything else. I mean, the very wealthy would go to hedge funds. What are they paying that fee for? If you think through it deeply, what are they doing? They are going for alternate asset class. I mean, most people who made a lot of money don't want a 20%. They don't want to gamble with it and say, you know, I want a 25% rate of return or something. They basically say, well, look, if I buy a T-bill, I'm going to get, till very recently, you know, 2 to 3%. If you can create another asset class by more diversification, by including different asset classes, give you 1% more, they're willing to pay for it. By the way, let me just ask a question. You think you can invest in stocks and bonds, right? What's the next asset? If you had to buy one more asset in your portfolio, which you should have, what would be the next one, which would give you a fair amount of increase in expected return for the same level of risk? What's the next asset? Any? No? Commodities. And if you didn't have commodities in your portfolio, again, you have lost out big time in the last so many years. Because combining gold, oil, lots of commodities, that's a good hedge. Actually, commodities are negatively correlated. It's a beautiful asset to add. Real estate, by the way, is a tough asset to analyze. Let me give you one-liner on that. Supposing I had $1 million portfolio and became $2 million in stocks and became $2 million in real estate. The consequences are very different, because if it became $2 million in stock, I could liquidate part of it and consumption smooth or something like that. If it became $2 million in real estate, what am I going to do? If I sell my house and buy another house next door, the damn thing is also appreciated, right? So my use value has not changed, unless I want to transfer assets across generations. Or unless I want to, you know, leave my Mountain View and move somewhere else, or you know, I cannot capitalize on that. So those that's for one reason. That's a very different asset for a portfolio hedge than commodities. And then you could go into many different classes of assets. But a lot of people, and it's very easy to buy commodities. Deutsche Bank has an ETF. and you could just go and buy that. I mean, it's just going to give you a good head. And also, U.S. oil, just now, about a week ago, there has been a couple of oil ETFs. Anybody can take part in the oil play. You can have gold. I mean, there's zillions of them given. Basically, why would you pay for a mutual fund? You don't want to do that, because especially in a taxable account, because as you know, if you buy a mutual fund, you could be holding the mutual fund, but if your manager sold it, and at a high frequency, you have to pay all the short-term capital gains taxes on it, even if you hold it, like, which is quite different from a stock. But if you do that with an ETF, you don't have to do it. So Vanguard, for all its funds, has comparable ETFs. So if you at all holding these in taxable accounts, there's no reason for you to buy mutual funds if you have a comparable ETF. Yes, sir. I would think the other way around. The risk premium in the economy right now has been sucked out of every market. You look at the term structure of interest rates. Start from 3-month T-bill to 20 years. It's 4%, right? It was even slightly inverted last summer where lots of hedge funds lost their shirt. Now, when there is no risk premium, is there a risk premium in the housing market? No, most people think rates will go up and you would take a loss. I mean, there is no risk premium left in the housing market except for some equity sectors. Most people will think, at least in the U.S. So when there is no risk premium left, what do? You amplify the bets because your clients want the rate of return. So basically, you are amplifying these bets, and when you amplify them that much, then you result in things like long-term capital. Actually, I'm quite scared that because there is no risk premium left, people are leveraging to such high extents. And people don't realize how much, you know, what can happen. And one of the key things is, I mean, risk controls are not that good in many organizations. No, I think good companies will have you make the things and then your friend pull the plug. Because if I let you pull the plug, what are you going to do? Supposing the stock market fell today, you would say, well, look, you know, maybe it'll go up tomorrow. Now you lost 3% or something like that. And if it fell again, you'll say, well, if it came back to the level yesterday, I will sell. And you could very quickly unravel. But see, the way asset management is run is the following. You promise your client a 3 sigma level. You say, this fund is designed not to lose 6% of your money, which means the portfolio that you have has 3 sigma of 6%. Now, this is a stochastic process, so the first day you could lose 5%. Is it possible? Sure, it can happen. Now, in a good hedge fund, what will happen for the next year? Now you got to lose only 1% over the whole year. So now what happens is now the 3 sigma level has to be 1%. So that portfolio composition has to change completely. I was advising a hedge fund last year when one time it was too risky for them even to hold T-bills. Because they had lost that much money. Because given their covenants with their, you know, stakeholders, you know, it had. Those of you who know a little bit about the market, very strange thing happened last summer. I was in Stockholm that day at the Institute of Financial Research, and the short rate went up. What would you expect when the short rate goes up? You'd think the long rate also goes up, right? But the long rate dipped. It dipped. And nobody knew what was happening, suddenly I was not holding that kind of an asset, but somebody was loving it. It was maybe the Chinese, maybe somebody else. They were buying that asset up, and it actually came out. So all positions inverted, right? And if you were taking leverage bets on it, you lost so much money that you had to pull out and be in cash at that point. Thank you.